The problem with others is that they are also people.
Welcome to Coffee with Creamer, where you get to sit down with our host, Dr. Barry Creamer, for a conversation about faith, life, and culture. We'll look at old ideas through a new lens, turn those culture wars on their head, and paint a picture of the way things could be. If you like your thinking deep and your coffee hot, pull up a chair. You're in the right place.
Now, that music, by the way, that you hear as we start into these discussions and you hear Daisy, our producer, speaking over it, that music was actually created by my son, Philip. So I just wanted to give him a shout out and say thanks for that. And I hope you enjoy the background music. And if you don't tell me, because it's my son and I'm not going to listen to you. I love this stuff anyway. This is right. My producer's saying, at the very end of the program, you hear some words, if you listen all the way to the very last seconds of the show, of the episodes, and it's a quotation from Shakespeare. So we leave you now with better company. And so if you hear it and you can't figure out what the words are, now you'll know what the words are. And yes, it's a self-deprecating statement. That's the case. By the way, also, I posted a devotional last week. So at our website, I post devotional each week based on these things that I send out to our staff and faculty at Criswell College, where I serve as the president. And they're just encouragements to remember to be spiritually motivated, minded as believers. And so I know not everybody who listens is a believer, but those of you who are, the devotionals might be an encouragement to you. So you can find them at barrycreamer.com. The one this last week, by the way, was about a cinnamon roll recipe, actually some icing recipes. Icing is the thing, after all, that my mom does. And so I actually posted the recipe for the cinnamon rolls there. They would be, you know, if you try it out, I'll put it this way. If you try it out, Daisy has said you need to send at least a sample to the college to her name so that she can try them out with you. Okay. So anyway, there's all that. So I want to get back to the statement that I made right at the top of the episode. The problem with others is that they're also people. This is the point of that statement that we overlook. In our everyday lives and in the day-to-day moments that we experience, we overlook just how restricted our lives are by others. And I'm not even saying that negatively. I'm saying it in a sense that we're just not very aware. In terms of self-awareness, we don't practice it very well. Because we don't realize how restricted our lives are by others. And by the way, the other side of this point is we don't realize how dependent we are, how much we need others for the things that make our lives meaningful and the things we desire in life. We're restricted by others entirely because we are dependent on others. I mean, when a parent says the words, "Hey, if you're under my roof, you're going to follow my rules," that's a parent saying, "Look, you accept my restrictions because you are dependent on me. You need me." And everybody likes to have a roof over their head and so on. And this is the thing. I mean, we don't want people to keep us from getting the stuff we desire, right? So that's why we get upset with other people when they impose on us, when they tell us what we can't do, when they're driving an hour lane of traffic too slow, when people are in our way. We don't like it. We don't want people to keep us from getting to the stuff we want. But what that means is, because think about the stuff we want. We don't want people keeping us from getting stuff we couldn't have if it weren't for the very same people who make it possible for us to have that stuff. That is, we want to use a really nice park. You know, you have lake. I have lake, White Rock Lake, not far from my house. $1 million away from my house or so. Anyway, I love going out to White Rock Park. And when I'm out there, when I'm riding my bike around the lake, I love it when there's nobody there. But I can hardly demand that they not be there. I don't want all the people in the way, but those people's taxes paid for the park to exist. It would not be there if it weren't for all of them. And that's inherently built into everything we think of. everything we desire, the things that we want. So we can talk about it a thousand different ways. We want, for instance, the conveniences of a city with a million people without the traffic of all those people getting to the things we and they created together. But, you know, they come hand in hand. And that's true about all of life, even if you're out in a rural setting instead of an urban setting, just for different reasons. In childhood, it's not like you're growing up as this libertarian entity, as an individual, inside your mother's womb. And, you know, during gestation, you pop out for a Slurpee somewhere and say, well, you know, I'll come back when I want to. Our childhood is a constant frustration. And I don't mean by that you don't enjoy all of it. You may enjoy all of it. But the reality is we're learning as children what we can't do constantly. And what we have in our imagination when we're children is that we'll become adults and then we'll be completely and totally free. And then we become adults and discover that we're anything but totally free, anything but that. Everything in the economy says we are not completely free. You pay for things when you buy them. You occupy space because somebody else is not occupying that space. When we share spaces, we have to buy them. And when we really like spaces, they become more expensive so that we have to pay more so that we can get to it and nobody else gets to it. Or somebody else gets it and we don't because they wanted it worse than us. When we are sharing spaces at a ball game, and we decide everybody's going to sing the Star Spangled Banner, then what we're saying is you have to commit to a shared set of values if you're going to share this space with me. That's what you have to do, which impinges on the liberty of each individual in that space. And we've seen a lot of that over the last couple of years. I'm not saying that's a bad thing. I'm saying it's an inherent part of being a human being. You are inherently part of a community. There are a lot of ways to say this. Poetically, there are some really brilliant statements about this. And I'll just pick two from a couple of my favorite poets. T.S. Eliot, in The Love Song of J. Alfred Prufrock, describes this same relationship where there's tension and irony. And he doesn't even describe this actually happening with this person, but it's in their imagination. They're certainly thinking it. When he makes the statement, there will be time to prepare a face to meet the faces that you meet. That utterance, to prepare a face to meet the faces that you meet, while it sounds like hypocrisy, is really the necessary ingredient of having a relationship with other people. It doesn't imply that somehow the face has to be so false that they can't really know you, but you know, thank heavens when people get up in the morning, they decide to shake off their gripiness or grumpiness or tiredness or whatever it is and get to work and say, hello, yes, I'm fine and so glad to see you, and to shake hands with courtesy and prepare a face to meet the faces that you meet. And we've all met people who don't put that on. And generally, it's not in a pleasant environment, and it's not someone we ever want to spend time with again. It's just part of courtesy to be willing to restrain yourself for the sake of the others who are around you. It's just part of being a community. For Robert Frost, it's in a poem called Mending Wall. Brilliant poem, brilliant title, Mending Wall. A wall, a fence, is there to create a mending between people so that you can have a healthier relationship. So he describes people repairing a fence that's fallen down, and that's how they have their relationship with each other. So it's a mending wall because they're relating to each other while they fix the wall. But at the same moment, they're mending a wall which is intended to keep them apart, and yet that's the thing that's bringing them together. So it's a brilliant irony in the poem overall. But listen to this language as he describes it, and as I'm reading it, it's a poem, so it's really hard to get in one reading, and I have a lot to cover, so I'm going to read it to you once. But as I'm reading it, think about this. What he's describing is this way of looking at this neighbor and seeing the wall that they're rebuilding with stones. They're repiling the stones so that they can keep each other apart. And he describes this neighbor that he has as carrying stones like a savage from the ancient times, and the threat that that would be to him, because that's the nature of relationships. They are all threatening, and yet we create a civilization so that we don't threaten each other. And so we live within bounds, restricted in the choices that we would make, because we care about the community we're a part of as well. And there's so much more to it than that. But here's the wording in that poem, something there is. It's called Mending Wall. something there is that doesn't love a wall because the wall has fallen down, and so they're having to mend it. They're having to fix it. So he says, something there is that doesn't love a wall, that wants it down. I could say elves to him, but it's not elves exactly. And I'd rather he said it for himself. I see him there, bringing a stone grasped firmly by the top in each hand, like an old stone savage armed. He moves in darkness, as it seems to me, not of woods only, in the shade of trees. He will not go behind his father's saying, though. And he likes having thought of it so well, he says again, good fences make good neighbors. That statement, good fences make good neighbors, which he uses throughout that poem, makes the point perfectly of what I'm talking about. The idea that you need a fence in order to have a neighbor is this point, that with community, with social obligations, come restrictions on what you would do as an individual if you didn't have those obligations. And the realization of it, not poetic form of it, but the reality of it in our lives, is that we know, both left and right, Republican and Democrat, we know, we agree that we need fences. Everybody knows there have to be restrictions. We have to restrain ourselves. We sometimes have to put restraints on others so that people can live responsibly in the society. And so each can have a fence around their life, their liberty, and their property. That's to protect their life, their liberty, and their property. So each person gets to put up a fence. Hey, stay out of my life, liberty, and property. This is mine. That's what we're talking about in the Constitution. I know you're thinking life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness, but that's a redundancy. Pursuit of happiness is a lot like liberty, right? So by the time it gets into the Constitution, then we recognize it's actually property, life, liberty, and property. People don't get to steal your stuff. But what we don't agree about, so you get to have a fence around your life, liberty, and property. We recognize that's part of what it means to have liberty. But what we don't agree about, what we don't necessarily agree about, and it's evident and obvious now in our society that we don't agree about it, is how far out those fences can go from you. How much protection do you get for your life, liberty, and property? At what point is your fence too far out from you and imposing on someone else's property? So for instance, and we don't even agree on what's included inside the fence line, what actually counts as part of your liberty. So for instance, we say, oh, well, I need a fence outside of my religious liberty. Clearly, you can't take my religious liberty from me. And we recognize that it's the first thing in the Bill of Rights. So obviously we want to maintain religious liberty. But does that include liberty for certain groups to offer live animal sacrifices for their religion? Wait a minute, maybe not. I'm not sure. So we don't know exactly even where to put fences on the most obvious cases. I'm not saying that means we shouldn't have a fence. I'm not saying it means there isn't a real boundary to be put down. But I am saying it means we have to have honest discussions with people who disagree with us about where those fences would be if we're going to live in a society together, which is the only way we can live, that we are social beings. That's what we're created to be. For instance, you have a right. Here's another fence that you're allowed to put up. You have a right to raise children according to your values. And we say, absolutely. You definitely ought to have the right to raise your children according to your own values protected. Does that mean you have freedom to prevent your child from receiving a life-saving blood transfusion because of your religion's belief about what blood is and what it means? Well, wait a minute. I don't know about that. Do I want that? That's a hard, now I'm not even trying to resolve that today. It's a legitimate biomedical ethics issue that we talk about. I would love to talk for a whole episode about that. Today I'm just raising the topic to say sometimes it's not as easy as we want it to be just to say, well, it's my child, I can do what I want. Well, not if it involves a closet and Velcro. You know, there are certain boundaries to what you get to do. So what makes for a good fence and what makes for a Berlin Wall is not always clear. You know, is this a reasonable boundary protecting your rights in this society? Or is this something that's excessive that you should not be able to put up? Or it's imposing on the ability for other people to be free? And because we need, the reason this is so important is because it's hard to tell the difference between a fence and a Berlin Wall, but also because we need a community. We are a community, every single one of us. is a community. Some of our fences are down. I mean, clearly and obviously, we don't have a lot of agreement about where they need to go back up. We're having a hard time agreeing which fences ought to exist, where they should be, and of what they should be constructed. You know, and an obvious place where I've seen some very heavy rocks being wielded by people on both sides of the fence that we need to mend, on both sides of the wall that we need to mend, is between mask advocates, you know, vaccine restriction advocates on the one hand, and then pro-life advocates, abortion restriction advocates on the other hand. And it's important here. Now, I teach logic at Criswell College, where I'm the president. I love the school. I love teaching logic. And there's a thing called a straw man argument you've all heard of. I always like to refer to what I see happening in a lot of our culture a lot of times as a straw Frankenstein argument, you know, which is not just a straw man. You know what a straw man is? You prop up some very weak argument in pretense as a caricature of some other person's position, and then you attack the straw man, which is really easy to defeat. A straw Frankenstein argument would be not one person's actual argument on the other side or a really weak form of that argument, but a bunch of arguments from different people that you cobble together as if one person said all of them. Well, they said this and that, and that's self-contradictory, and not the same person said it. So I call that a straw Frankenstein argument. I'm just making it up. Cobbling together arguments from they. Well, they say, and they're not all the same people. But anyway, I'm not doing that with this. That's not the point. The point is not that I'm saying, well, all those pro-mask vaccine restriction people say, or all of those pro-life and anti-abortion people say. I'm not saying that at all. I am simply presenting actual arguments that I've heard made from each side against the other because each of these has some merit. Not to tear them down and say, oh, what a bunch of hypocrites. That's not the point. The point is, as I hear them make their argument, I'm saying, well, I don't think the other side heard that. And I think maybe we should have heard it. Does it mean you have to change your opinion about whether you're pro-mask or pro-abortion or whatever? No, it won't necessarily mean that. But it does mean we have to think about what it implies about our own understanding of where our personal liberties and our community obligations come together at the point where we need a fence, where we need a wall or a boundary. So here's where I've heard these arguments, and these come up all the time. This is the argument that I've heard from the pro-vaccine, pro-mask, pro-restriction, pro-quarantine type people. And I'm not saying from everybody. I'm not saying everybody makes this argument, but I'm saying I've seen people make this exact argument, which is, how can you say it's my body, you can't force me to put a vaccine in it against my will, and then not understand the pro-choice argument? This is what I've heard some pro-vaccine people say. Now, I'm in favor of people getting vaccines. I'm not in favor of a mandate. I don't believe we need to do that. I'm in favor of informed consent and protecting the rights of people. But I am in favor of getting the vaccine. So I'm a pro-vaccine person, not mildly so, but like, go get the vaccine. Not be mandated to go get the vaccine, but just go do it. Go get the vaccine, help us in the pandemic, move forward. That's me. I hold that position. You don't have to hold that position, but that's mine. I'm also pro-life, so I'm being transparent about who I am. This is who I am. I'm in favor of both of these things. So I do not look at it and say, oh, well, this argument proves that if you're a pro-vaccine, you have to be pro-choice. I'm not saying that. I'm saying to people who are responding to those who are resistant to getting the vaccine, they're saying, these pro-vaccine people, they're saying, and I'm not all of them, but I've heard people make this exact argument. How on earth can a pro-life person say, this is my body, you can't force me to put a vaccine in it against my will, and then not understand the pro-choice argument, that it's not just about a baby, it's about what the government gets to tell me about my body? Now, I don't know whether that means the pro-vaccine person should then be saying, well, I'm not in favor of a vaccine mandate, or if it means the pro-life person should reconsider whether the pro-choice people have an argument. I actually do. You can tell what my position is. I'm in favor of getting the vaccine voluntarily, and I'm pro-life. That makes sense to me as a solution to it. That was the argument from the pro-vaccine people against pro-life people. The argument I've heard pro-life people make against pro-vaxxers, pro-mask people is, how can you say it's not about your liberty, it's about others' lives, and then not understand our pro-life argument, that it's not about your choice, it's about the baby's life? Notice the points of intersection or conflict in these discussions, where there are people who want different rules. So I want a rule that says I don't want a rule that says you have to have a vaccine mandate, or I want a rule that says you cannot get an abortion, you know, something like that. Where there are people who want different rules, vaccine mandates or abortion restrictions, then there's a conflict. Wait, you want a rule that I think violates my liberty too much. You want a rule that I think neglects community interests too much, whatever it is. Or you want to avoid a rule that I think would defend community interests and so on. So where that happens, then there's conflict. But also there's conflict where the rules require one person to give something up for the sake of another person. That's an inherent conflict. It doesn't mean it has to be hostile. It doesn't mean you have to choose to be their enemy. But it does mean there's a conflict of interest. And part of our calling as believers, especially, but just as citizens of a community, is to recognize the value of giving things up for others. That's what a healthy citizenship means. You know, you're willing to give things up for others. And so where the rules require one person to give something up for the sake of another person and conflict arises, then we're supposed to say, oh, wait a minute, where would that fence be best placed? So for the pro-life, we're asking to give up access to abortion for the sake of the unborn life. And that's what I do. I ask for that. You know, give up the right to abortion for the sake of that unborn life. But that is giving up the right to something. It is giving up a choice that you would have had otherwise. And the pro-vax, pro-mask mandates, the pro-restrictions people are saying, let's just do it in terms of masks for a second. They're saying, give up an open face, give up informed consent, if it were about vaccines, for the sake of people who are vulnerable to COVID. Give it up for the sake of other people who might die because you didn't restrict your behavior enough. That's a reasonable parallel. It's not an unreasonable argument to make that we should consider those in light of one another. I'm not saying how to resolve that debate about masks or about abortion right now, although I'm pro-life. I'm not questioning that. But I am saying this. The point of intersection there was the balance between personal liberties and then community obligations, our obligation to other people. So what we've noticed over the last, oh, I don't know, however long, let's say last 20 years or so, what I've noticed is an increasing use of this word. It's a word used as often as lately fascism and Marxism have been used to describe the far right and the far left, you know. And it's tyranny. So this is tyrannical. This kind of dictatorial tyranny is, you know, will not, and we hear that. So I hear this word a lot right now. And the, you know, the basic question is, at what point is the government reaching too far? How do you define government overreach? And you know what really bothers me about this is that we weren't saying it. And I just mean people in general. I did hear it from some people, but I mean in society, we weren't all upset about it, all up in arms, when it was about tobacco restrictions, for instance. So we're not going to allow people to smoke in restaurants anymore. I don't smoke. I don't like the smell of smoke. I don't want to smoke, and I don't want other people to smoke. But I don't think I have a right to demand other people not to smoke. So what we did, and I say we, I just mean our culture in general, is we worked really hard at secondhand smoke effect, you know, research to find out if it was causing cancer in people who weren't smoking, to say that it was a public health concern, and therefore we need to move smoking out of the buildings and so on. And so when it came to tobacco restrictions, and I would say the same thing about drug restrictions in general, but that's so long ensconced in our culture, people don't really hear the argument the way it's presented. But about drug restrictions the same way back in the early 20th century, you know, people who opposed the restrictions opposed it because it was a libertarian violation. What right do you have to tell a restaurant that they can't let people smoke in their restaurant? And the answer, well, it's a public health concern. Now, it is a public health concern in one sense. Statistically, you can improve the public's health if you can keep people from smoking. That makes sense. But it's a little disingenuous to call it a public health concern when the mandate only affects the public statistically. That is, when the mandate only directly affects the health of the people who are being restricted, you know, the smoker or the drug user. That's a different kind of public health advantage than saying, I don't want you to spread the black plague to your community. That's a completely different kind of public health interest. And nobody, not enough people are making that distinction. So here's the point I'm making. Just pause with me for a second and think about this. When we think about government overreach and saying, well, that's tyranny if they're demanding that you, and in this case, not smoke in a public place. The point of intersection, the point where the fence would be, where the government has put a fence, is where they believe your liberty to smoke violates the community's liberty to be free of smoke. So I don't want to smell smoke, but I don't think the government should have had the right to tell you can't smoke just because I don't want to smell your smoke and I don't want to smoke. But they did, and we let it go no problem. I mean, in fact, we're all glad about it. I love walking into restaurants and not having to smell other people's smoke. I do. I'm ashamed that I'm so content with that fact, but I am content with it. I apologize to all of you who are smoking, but you should stop smoking anyway because it's better for you. Informed consent. You're informed? Consent. Stop smoking. Anyway, the point is, if you look at it in terms of tobacco restrictions, you can understand what I'm talking about. If you look at it in terms of a mask mandate, it's exactly the same issue. Or an abortion restriction. You are impeding one person's choice in the tobacco case about whether you can smoke or not, for another person's benefit. But now it's not just a smoke-free environment or the unlikely nature of secondhand smoke exposure, which may be terrible. I don't know. I'm not a scientist. I don't do that research. But I know it's not as significant as COVID or as the consequence of an abortion, losing an unborn life. So a mask mandate or an abortion restriction is at exactly the same point of intersection between one person's liberty and then the society's need for people to consider their community obligations instead of their liberties. So where are Christians? Where are believers? And I'm just going to speak to believers for a second. But if you're listening, you're not a believer, then you can just think about what this should mean, I think, to those of us who are believers. You know, what's our goal for Christian influence in a culture about where the government would put down restrictions like that? What should a Christian be voting for in that kind of environment? And I'm not going to say vote this way or vote that way. I'm just talking about the basic point. Christianity forms in a world where it is the counterculture, where there is an empire of power demanding that you worship a certain way and live a certain way, and that's how shared values are expressed in communities or empires or however big the expression of it goes. But that's where Christianity forms. But it does not make sense for a mature form of Christianity as a whole to be restricted to that kind of function, meaning Christianity can't be a religion that only survives if it has a government that's opposed to it. That doesn't make sense because we're praying from the beginning in our Christianity, according to Paul's lesson to Timothy, you know, in 1 Timothy 2, we're praying for our leaders so that we could live godly and quiet and peaceable and dignified lives in that society. So it doesn't make sense that it has to be antithetical to Christianity for it to succeed. But on the other hand, and this is way down at the other end of the spectrum, in between, you know, there are all kinds. You could have a government that's opposed to Christianity but tolerates it. You could have a government that's Christian but treats all other religions with equality. You could have, and so on. All the way down the line, the far extreme would be a Christianity that requires cultural conformity, that it exercises a hegemony, you know, a unique and total power over that culture to have to express things that are Christian. That would not be true to Christianity's early form. It just would not work with the way Christianity is described. And I'll give you a passage. I'm going to read you the quote from Mark 10 that you anticipate probably, recognizing that this is about individuals serving individuals. I get that. But the whole point is that he's using the model of how governments work, of how those who are in authority over people work. And he says that's not what a Christian is supposed to be like. So the idea that Christianity, which can't be like this, is supposed to express itself in the power of legislation to cause others to conform to what we think, and that that somehow would express our Christianity, that's unacceptable. That is not at all to say that we should not vote for laws that protect the unborn, for instance, or vote for laws that protect any kind of victim or the vulnerable, because we advocate for Christian values and the government does carry a sword. But it does mean our Christianity cannot be an effort to overthrow the masses with the power that we garner somewhere. That just would not be consistent. And so the one in Mark 10, you know, is the one that says, you know, those who are considered rulers over the nations, they lord it over them, and their great ones exercise authority over them. But it shall not be so among you. Whoever among you would be greatest must be your servant. Whoever would be first among you must be slave of all. So let's take a parenthetical break here for a second for an example of how little self-awareness we have when it comes to balancing our self-interest and our obligation to others. So if you really want evidence that we don't understand how much we have moved the fences and expectations about liberty and our obligations to the community, then marriage is a perfect example. Historically, marriage meant a social obligation, a social commitment, stability for the village and the community, a future through children. Those went hand in hand. You got married in order to have children. Shared values that would then be passed down. And those shared values were the community's values, which is why the marriage was endorsed by those who expressed the community's values, the clergy. The historical evidence that marriage is a public institution, a social institution, makes this obvious. Arranged marriages, parents who arranged them with each other, or whole villages that would arrange marriages with each other. The requirement for a license, forget an arranged marriage, even if you choose who you're going to marry, like we do now in Western society, then you still have to go get a license, approval from the society that you are able to marry the person that you have chosen. But a public ceremony in which you have witnesses and then an authority expresses the sanctioning of the relationship. And it's a clergy or a judicial authority. And the fact that after you're married, you have to go get approval from that same kind of authority, a state authority in particular, in order to get a divorce, is evidence that your marriage is not about you. It's about your obligation to the community. That's built into our history. It is not confusing at all historically. But our contemporary understanding of marriage, at least in the West, is all about the individual and practically ignores the community obligation. We still have vestiges of it in our ceremonies, but they are just residual. So for instance, when a person gets married now, you do it for self-fulfillment, not even for the fulfillment of the other person, but so that you yourself can be a more complete individual. Now I will be fulfilled in this other person. The evidence of that change, by the way, is in how we select our mate. It's completely personal. Even in terms of the family, going to a parent now and asking for permission is exceptional, and it's a granted that the parent has to say yes, or you're going to go off and get married anyway. There's no real approval in the process because it's about you as an individual. The requirement that that approval be granted without exception by the society, meaning you don't have a right to tell any couple that they can't get married. In fact, we would almost find that kind of idea that some justice of the peace somewhere could say to a couple, no, y'all are not good for us. We don't see that working out well for our society. That's so absurd to us, we now recognize it in Obergefell's decision that every individual can select who they're going to marry, and the state has no right to intervene and say that you should not be married to that person. And like it or dislike it, I'm saying this is an intersection of our community obligation, our obligation to our society, and then the rights that we claim as individuals. This is one where we've made a huge shift. And for some believers, they would love to go back and say, no, you want approval for your marriage, then you only you only marry the people that we approve of you marrying. And there are people who are on the other side who are saying, look, there's no community obligation whatsoever. And at the same moment saying, we demand that the community approve of our marriage because we recognize that it still is a community relationship, an obligation that's social and not just private. It's the ultimate irony watching marriage play out in such a libertarian society that doesn't recognize the value that we still do place on the community, on the society. And that's why we all run around saying we're promoting freedom and all ignore that we're also promoting social obligations. And we just don't agree about where those social obligations and where those freedoms should be. The acceptance, by the way, of any officiant now for a ceremony is evidence that that's just a residue of history. We don't really care about the ceremony. Go online, get a certificate. Yeah, I'm from the Church of Marrying People, and I'm going to marry you right now. That's what we're into now because we recognize, it's just these two people making a commitment to each other. And the evidence of that, by the way, with divorce, where you have to get a divorce in order to dissolve this public institution of marriage, you have to get a divorce. But now we've said, well, we're really close to just letting you do it whenever you want because it's no-fault divorce. The only limit on it now, really, is that you got to spend some money on a lawyer to get a divorce. And that's why it's so commonly practiced, especially after children are raised, when you have fulfilled that desire in your life to do that for yourself, and it's not really about the society as a whole. If we don't recognize the relationship with our own spouse as more important than ourselves alone as individuals, And this is the case. I mean, for most of our society, we don't. And we don't even recognize why, but we don't. Then imagine what that means for how important we regard those who are on the far end of the ideological or sociological spectrum from us. What it means for a right-wing Republican to think about a left-wing Democrat or vice versa. What it means for people who think about an immigrant who doesn't even speak our language or celebrate our holidays anymore. It is a massive shift when we stop recognizing that the community to which we have such a great obligation is made up of people who are just like us, meaning they have rights just like us, and we recognize those rights. And I could spend all day expanding on that and why that applies even when we're talking about people across the border, but that's not the point. Here's the point. We need to start thinking of those people who want those other rules, those people who have a different way of thinking about the world, those people who are imposing mandates on us that we don't want, not just as the ones around whom we need to build fences, not just as the reason to protect ourselves with bigger fences or walls around us, but as neighbors, the kind Jesus finds at a well in Samaria, the kind a Samaritan finds on a road from Jerusalem, and the kind God told us to love the way we already love and protect and defend ourselves.
Thank Thanks for joining us for Coffee with Creamer. Your cup of coffee may be finished, but we are not. Come back next week for a refill as we sit down to examine a new set of ideas and cultural issues. Don't miss an episode. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts or visit our website at barrycreamer.com. Until next time, keep your mug hot and your mind sharp.